I'm Karen Florin, and this is the Storyline Podcast. Today, I'm here with Jennifer Muggio, Deputy Director of the Ledgelight Health District. We're here to talk about the recent spike in fentanyl overdoses and what help is available. Good afternoon, Jennifer, and welcome to the day. Could you give us a little overview on what's been happening?
Sure. Thanks for having me, Karen, and to talk about this really important matter to our community members. As we've all been aware of over the last now more than a decade, really, we've been monitoring the overdose epidemic. And while often people will refer to this as the opioid crisis or something like that, we really want to frame this as being an issue of having more overdoses, fatal and non-fatal, in our community than we would like to see. And we say every overdose is a preventable result of a policy failure. The reason we say that is because of a number of reasons. The first is that continues to be a coverage gap between the access to evidence-based treatment and the need in our community. The second is that we have harm reduction support and resources that are available, although not enough. Those include naloxone and fentanyl test strips. Naloxone continues to be expensive. We've made great strides in Connecticut in terms of policies, making it accessible through the pharmacies, but there's still many, many barriers. And finally, we say it's a policy failure because many of the overdoses happen as a result of the adulterated drug supply. And that is a direct result of our prohibition policies.
Okay, so let's break this down a little bit. Probably back in the decade ago that you mentioned, what the overdoses were the result of heroin. Now there are synthetic drugs. What are you seeing in terms of, is there actually still heroin in use, or is it all fentanyl?
For the most part, the heroin supply has been overtaken by fentanyl. And many people who were using heroin are knowingly now using fentanyl. As many people know, people develop a tolerance for opioids. And so the use of the stronger opioid brings them to that sense of normalcy and relief of symptoms of withdrawal, and kind of helps them achieve that equilibrium because now they've developed the tolerance. The challenge is that because of incidental cross-contamination, for the most part, fentanyl is showing up in the supply of other drugs as well. And particularly concerning is for people who are stimulant users, who their drug of choice may be crack or cocaine. First of all, they're often opioid naive, so they don't have a tolerance, which means their risk of overdose associated with using fentanyl is higher. And second of all, it's not part of their awareness of their health and the health of the people that are using with them. So educating stimulant users in terms of what an opioid overdose looks like, how to recognize and respond to one, and the need for them to have naloxone, and especially important with stimulants, is to use the fentanyl test strips. Because the beauty of the fentanyl test strips is they test positive, yes or no, for fentanyl. It's not much help to someone who's using heroin or knowingly using fentanyl because they just say yes or no, there's fentanyl in this. They can't tell us how much fentanyl. But for people who are using stimulants or not expecting for there to be fentanyl, that yes or no could be a lifesaver. It's information that they can use to adjust their use and make an informed decision about their use, to not use that supply that day, to use less of it, to not use alone, to have somebody by who has naloxone. And I want to be clear, too, that we're not just talking about crack and cocaine. We're also talking about pressed pills. So oftentimes people are buying what they think are oxys or benzos in a pill form. And in fact, those pills have been are counterfeit. They're not coming out of a pharmaceutical factory. And so taking a tiny little bit of that pill, crushing it up, adding some water to dissolve it, and testing it with the fentanyl test strips could make all the difference in the world.
And so you mentioned two policy failures. Let's break those down a little bit. Access to evidence-based treatment, there's a gap. What is right now the evidence-based treatment that is most recommended? And tell me about the gap.
Sure. So the gold standard in evidence-based treatment for opioid use disorder is methadone. Unfortunately, for decades now, the methadone policies in this country have really restricted access. We can only access methadone treatment at certified opioid treatment programs. They are few and far between. And the regulations require most people to show up every day, to stand in line a lot of times, to show up very early in the morning a lot of times. And the tightness around those restrictions make it a treatment that is not possible for many people to adhere to. We talk about patients being non-compliant, but how can you be a compliant with a treatment that requires you to center your whole life around accessing it? How can you sustain your taking care of your kids and your job and all of the things that go into daily healthy living if you have to be somewhere, rain or shine, snow or sleet, car broken down or not, in order to get your medicine? So one of the policy changes we'd like to see is much fewer restrictions on access to methadone. In other countries, you can go get your methadone at the pharmacy. Your primary care provider can prescribe methadone. And what's funny is that there are allowances for methadone to be prescribed by other clinicians for pain relief, but not for treatment of opioid use disorder. And we are this far into this crisis of too many people dying. It's a policy that absolutely we need to change. The second evidence-based treatment that's really effective is buprenorphine or Suboxone. And while there are fewer restrictions around that, you don't have to show up every day to get dosed. It is a prescription you can pick up and take it home. There are still restrictions around the prescribing of it. And so eliminating the requirement for clinicians to go through special training and have a DEA waiver to prescribe buprenorphine is something that we'd like to see. And we're seeing also reports of the DEA cracking down on where we used to read about them investigating clinicians who were prescribing too many pharmaceutical opioid pain relievers. Now we're seeing reports of them investigating clinicians who are prescribing too much buprenorphine or pharmacies who are dispensing too much buprenorphine. So we continue to have these restrictive policies and practices that mean people cannot access these life-saving medications.
The conversation has changed since in the past decade, because before we were talking about people going into detox and treatment. With these life-saving medications, that's no longer necessary.
So it's an interesting conversation for us to have. There are evidence-based treatments. These for opioid use disorder. There are also medications for alcohol use disorder. There's indications that different treatment modalities, different ways of accessing clinical support work differently for different people. But for so long, we've had this idea that in order to get well from your substance use disorder, you need to go into an inpatient treatment program. You need to follow these steps. Families are encouraged to have their loved ones sign a contract to go to a certain number of meetings in 30 days and things like that. I don't want to disparage the social supports, the emotional connection that folks achieve through some of these programs. And many people will say that participating in those programs is what helped them on the path to wellness. But the fact is that they're not clinical treatments, and we have clinical treatments. Going through detox from opioid use disorder in particular is a dehumanizing, painful, horrible experience. And the idea that someone needs to suffer through that experience, that they need to hit rock bottom and they need to be punished physically for their use disorder is one that makes my skin crawl. People use drugs for so many different reasons. And many times people are using drugs to help them manage the pain of life, to help them deal with the ramifications of a trauma experience or a lifetime of trauma, to help them manage physical pain that they've been unable to heal from. They start using drugs because of social connections. And all of us who have met our friends for a glass of wine at a happy hour can relate to that. Most people who use drugs don't develop a substance use disorder. But for the people who do develop a substance use disorder, we need to take a step back and completely reframe and reevaluate how we support them on their path to wellness.
So the second coverage gap that you mentioned was harm reduction, and you talked about naloxone and the fentanyl test strips. Those are methods of harm reduction. And could you talk a little bit about where somebody can access these and the conversation around harm reduction being, so you're sort of endorsing somebody's drug use, which I know is, of course, not the case.
So what we're doing with harm reduction is simply that. We're reducing the harms associated with someone using drugs and possibly suffering severe illness or death. We are not judging anybody's decision to use drugs. We just want to help them use safer. Now, the evidence tells us that people who engage with harm reduction services are 5 times more likely to engage with treatment. But our goal is not to have folks engage with treatment. Our goal is for folks to be healthy and alive, even if they are going to continue to use drugs. It's possible for that to happen. So saturating our community with naloxone, helping people to have conversations with their friends and family members so that they are not using in secrecy, so those friends and family members are prepared to administer the naloxone. They know where it is. They know how to recognize that somebody is experiencing an overdose. Is very, very important to saving lives. Naloxone is tremendously effective when administered in a timely manner during the overdose. But it has to be administered by somebody.
Within minutes?
Well, as soon as possible. It's hard to answer that question and with an exact number because every overdose is different. Everybody's going to experience a different onset relative to the strength of the dose that they took, to other substances they have on board. One thing that we're seeing happening with the drug supply now is that a number of the deaths in 2020, we haven't looked at the 2021 data in detail yet, we're doing that now, but a number of the deaths in 2020 tested positive not only for fentanyl, but also for a chemical called xylazine, which is actually an animal tranquilizer. So xylazine is not an opioid, and it won't respond to naloxone. but it has some of the same impacts on our physiology that the opioids do. So if somebody's breathing has been depressed as a result of having both fentanyl and xylazine on board, the naloxone is going to kick the fentanyl off the opioid receptors, and your brain is going to stop receiving the signal from the opioid receptors to stop breathing because of that, but it may have been impacted from the xylazine.
Excuse me, Jennifer. Sure. Is there a street name for that xylazine that we may be more familiar with?
So there's not a street name for xylazine because people are not seeking it out and using it in and of itself. What we understand is that this has actually been in the supply of heroin in different cities. In 2020, Philadelphia had the highest rate of xylazine in tox screens, followed by the state of Maryland, followed by the state of Connecticut, which was showing up in 10%. And when we looked at our local data for 2020, it was showing up in 13% within the Ledge Light Health District fatalities. So it's up there. But it is something that is used to cut heroin. Some people in Philadelphia, especially, are knowingly seeking it out because of the way that it kind of softens the edges on the fentanyl withdrawal. So fentanyl, if you have this really high up, sharp spike up from the fentanyl coming on board, you're also going to have that sharp spike down from the fentanyl coming on board. And if it cut with the right amount, the xylazine will just kind of ease you out of that. Unfortunately, of course, because none of these things are being produced in a factory, the wrong amount is often included, not intentionally, but just because people are not using...
They're not pharmacists, they're not chemists.
They're not using those scales and everything. And so people are experiencing kind of these sudden blackouts, falling and walking down the street 1 minute and cracking their head open the next. Xylazine also can result in pretty horrific wounds, and they can be systemic. So they can show up at the site of injection if somebody is injecting drugs, but they can also show up at other sites. So to answer your question about the street name, some people in Philadelphia who are seeking it out call it something like trank dope.
Okay.
Because it's a tranquilizer combined with dope. What we've learned from our community members, talking with our community members here, is that many of them were unaware of this being possibly included in the supply. And they could relate to the vision of somebody experiencing that type of response, where it just seemed like they were out of it a lot stronger and a lot faster than they were when they were just using fentanyl. But they weren't aware of why.
Amazing. So the game changes, and it's so hard to keep up with everything. These test strips for fentanyl, would they be effective with xylazine?
No. Yeah, okay. They're only for fentanyl. And what you just said is so important, right? And it's the problem with our policy response being so focused on prohibition. If you look back at our initial policy responses to this wave of epidemic, were to restrict access to pharmaceutical opioids, implement the prescription drug monitoring program, restrict the number of pills that somebody could get at visiting for a first time visit to the emergency department or something like that. The challenge is, right, that the restriction to the access to those pharmaceutical opioids, which were being produced in a factory, were consistent. Every pill in that bottle contained the same amount of opioid. You could predict how much you were using and what your response might be. And I'm not discounting the fact that people did die from using too many. I don't want to make it seem like that didn't result in harm to our community, but restricting access opened a vacuum into which the narco traffickers introduced fentanyl. And so restricting access created a situation where we have more harm in our community. And now we've spent a few years learning about fentanyl, getting these fentanyl test strips, educating policymakers and community members about fentanyl. And now, on top of that, we have to learn about xylazine and what's the next substance and what's the next substance. We can just, it's a pattern, right? We restrict access to one substance, another substance then steps into that space, and another substance and another substance. It seems pointless, this continued focus on restricting access to the particular substance. It doesn't stop people from using drugs. It creates a situation where using drugs is more deadly than ever before, and we need a new frame.
Thank you, Jennifer. I can see your commitment to this and your compassion and passion for it. Would you just say a little bit about the nature of substance use disorder and who is affected by it, and then quickly give us some hope and contact for people who are seeking out help?
Sure. So substance use disorder can happen. We've heard this over and over again. It doesn't discriminate. It can happen to anyone. I don't want, though, to shy away from acknowledging the fact that inequities in all of our other systems mean that for some people, substance use disorder becomes more deadly, more challenging to achieve wellness from than for others. Rates of drug use across our population between racial groups are the same, if not more, among white people. Rates of developing a substance use disorder associated with drug use are the same. The challenge is, of course, responding to the development of that substance use disorder. So because white people are more likely to have access to regular health care, they're more likely to have the social and economic supports necessary to early identify substance use disorder and respond to it. They're more likely to be able to have a job that allows them that flexibility to access methadone or go for regular treatment appointments. They're more likely to be received into care because of their experience of whiteness and being received in the world, knowing that these systems are there to support us. The inequities in access to health insurance and access to having a primary care provider that we feel trust, we feel safe with, the access to employment and economic security and safe and healthy housing and all of the things that help us be well in life, we know that that access is less for Black and Hispanic people in our community because of structural racism in all of those domains. So substance use disorder can happen to everyone. It impacts everyone. And we need to pay attention to how our systems impact outcomes for people of color. In terms of hope, I hope that people out there hear a few things. The first is, using drugs does not mean you have a substance use disorder and that treatment is appropriate. If you know that someone in your life is using drugs, please receive them with the love and care that you did before you found that out. Help them know, if they're using only occasionally, the risk of the adulterated supply, to know about accessing fentanyl test strips, to make sure that they are not using alone, and that somebody's nearby with naloxone. The other thing is that for the small percentage of people who do use drugs, who go on to develop a substance use disorder, many, many people do recover. Many people live long and healthy lives and enjoy all of those things in life that bring us joy. There is so much hope. We just want you to be safe and alive on that journey. If there's anybody out there who'd like to receive more information, like to connect with our navigators for support in accessing the resources, information, treatment that's available in our community, would like to get a naloxone kit or fentanyl test strips or learn more about syringe services, another harm reduction method we haven't talked about, you can call or text the NLC CARES line at 860-333-3494.
Thank you so much, Jennifer. I'd love if you would come back someday and we could actually break down deeper into some of these topics.
Be happy to.